I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. The journalist Ethan Liu joins me now. He has just published Field Notes from a Pandemic, A Journey Through a World Suspended. It is one of the first books to document what it's been like living through the COVID-19 pandemic. Mr. Liu leaves Toronto in January 2020, just as a novel coronavirus has begun to be talked about in North America. He is going to China to visit his ailing grandfather. He tries to go to Hong Kong next, but then goes to Singapore, where he grew up and where his parents now live. His plans are to go to parts of Europe and then the United States, but it's largely in Germany where he goes next, another place he had spent some time in before, but was obviously very different as the world was shutting down and people were in quarantine. The book, even though it's all just this year, gives us a sense of what it was like in different places. It illustrates the struggle many had in getting home from other places, as well as a deep isolation that has surrounded all of us during these past 9 months. The world is not back to normal, and as we expect a second wave, I ask Ethan about what we know better and whether we'll all remember those lessons. We talk about leadership and the lack thereof, and we talk about how different the world is and will always be. Ethan Liu was a staff writer for Reuters and has written for numerous publications, including The Guardian, The South China Morning Post, The Washington Post, The Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, Maclean's, and The Walrus. Visit his website at ethanliu.com. This new book is published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. We taped this interview last week, Tuesday, the 29th of September. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Ethan Liu. Mr. Liu, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining
us.
It's good to talk to you. As I was telling you just before we started, I enjoyed the book a great deal. The book begins and ends with you talking about your grandfather. You start the year, as it were, and the book by going to China to see him. He's in a nursing home, is that right?
That is correct.
So how is he today?
He is about the same as when I saw him last. So he has been that way. He's been steadily declining, as you would have read in the book, for quite some time, and he hasn't been able to recognize me for a while. But last year, that was when things got really serious. There was a point when my father told me to prepare a dark suit. Those were his exact words.
Yeah.
So there was a feeling that that might be the last time I'd see him, and there was actually talk of pulling the plug among the children, although it never came to that. And yeah, right now he made it through everything, and he is the same as he has been for the past year.
So before you go on that trip to China to visit him, a friend of yours says don't die, thinking about what's going to happen in the world with COVID and the sort. Those were early days. Did you think he was overreacting?
Well, I think he was also half-joking because, as you said, those were very early days. And as you would have read in the book, on the day I left, the Globe and Mail newsletter had just two lines and one cartoon on the matter. And China has been accused of covering up the matter in the early days. So I don't think there was much of a virus consciousness in the world at all. And in retrospect, everything looks so clear. But I think at the time, who could know?
Yeah. The other thing that as I was reading the book, you know, because we've all been living through it in our own way, small or big, I kept wondering, at what point did you think there was a book here? I mean, this has come together pretty quickly in terms of how books are published. How did this book come about?
Mm-hmm. So, it was about the middle of March, and so I had written another book before this, Once a Bitcoin Miner, and I had been talking with my agent before the pandemic. We were talking about the next book, and I had plenty of ideas, but this was not one of them. And the idea for this, that was actually planted by my agent. He suggested this after there was a piece in Maclean's that I wrote about the experience in China, and there was quite a lot of reaction from that. I got a lot of emails, and I appeared on TV for a while for that. So yeah. this kind of came from that.
And so for people listening to us, throughout this the last 9 months or so, you've gone to China. What was the next step? Was the next step Hong Kong or was that Singapore?
Well, it was supposed to be Hong Kong.
Right.
But on the day that I left, the night before that, Hong Kong, they put in a rule that anyone arriving from the mainland had to be quarantined upon arrival. And it hadn't come into effect yet, but all sorts of flights were cancelled as a result. So I never actually made it to Hong Kong, but Singapore, that was the next stop.
And you'd spent a number of years there growing up, is that correct? Your parents live there now, right?
Yeah, that is correct. So I think 13 years, all of my pre-university schooling was done there.
Yeah. You were there during SARS, is that right?
Yes, that is correct. But SARS, as I write in the book, it's a whole different thing from what we are experiencing now. I think primarily China's share of the world economy back then, that was like a fourth of what it is now.
Right.
And I don't think I quite appreciated the seriousness of SARS, particularly because I was a kid back then. I remember that schools were suspended, but you know, nobody was wearing masks back then. Things were still normal, even during SARS.
You mentioned in the book you describe what it's like to be tested, and you talk about your fear of being tested, and other. I mean, for people listening to us in this country, in Canada at least, I don't know what it's like in Toronto, but in Vancouver, certainly there have been long lines at these outdoor testing stations, and so I mean, other than waiting for a while for a test, that's something I'd like to avoid. I mean, it is rather painful, isn't it? I mean, you didn't even get the test yourself, I think, right?
No, I didn't have any reason to be tested,
yeah.
But I'm not actively avoiding a test. If I have reason to be tested, I'll
sure.
get myself a test. But as you said, it's not a very pleasant thing.
There are a couple of moments in the book where you illustrate the fear of catching COVID so well. It reminded me of, I mean, you know, I've done what most people have done. I mean, I've stayed home for most of the time, but I've also gone out. Actually, I go out regularly, so I shouldn't say that. But, I mean, I'm pretty careful about what I do when I'm out and about. But there are some wonderfully written moments in the book where the thought crosses your mind that it was possible. And you write about the fear of catching COVID. The other thing that struck me as I was reading those moments, I mean, they were largely where you were isolated from a lot of people. What's that like? I mean, can you describe that as to how the fear is, especially if you're alone?
Mm-hmm. So I had a scare because there was a guy I interacted with, as you would have read, one day I woke up to find that he had tested positive. It was just a couple of days after we met.
Yeah.
But I later found out, and it wasn't that much later. It was within the same day that it's confirmed that he tested positive after he had landed in Sweden because his whole family had COVID and he caught it from them. But between that, there was this feeling within me, and I thought, you know, we breathe the same air. Could he have given it to me? And I think I speak very bad German. I left when I was six. I don't think my German has progressed beyond the level of a six-year-old.
Right.
And I thought, you know, who would I go to if I suspect that I have COVID?
Yeah, I found that particularly illustrative because for a lot of people, I mean, we've all read this and heard this, that COVID has hit people who are generally not well off or who are, say, immigrants to a certain country. And I guess we overlook that, don't we?
Yes, and I think definitely there's a disproportionate impact on the underprivileged. And I remember reading a headline a couple of days ago that for white-collar workers, the impact on them, at least financially, it has gone. They're all back to where they were before the pandemic. But for the blue-collar workers, it has not been like that.
Yeah. There's some vivid pictures that you paint in the book, scenes out of movies even, pictures of dystopia. I mean, I'm thinking of some of the images that I read in the book of what it was like in China in those early days, you know, going through lockdown, you know, identifying yourself at restaurants and the sort. Did you find the isolation that you experienced, the loneliness, say, whether it was in Germany or even in Singapore, was that tough to bear? I mean, I'm wondering what kept you grounded through all of this.
Mm-hmm. So I think basically two things. One is that I think I'm an introvert. I'm a guy who likes solitude, and I think being by myself with just my thoughts as company, it's not that bad. But of course, I think everyone needs human interaction. As I write in the book, I think that there's a reason that killer whales, when they're kept in captivity, that the dorsal fins just collapse. And we actually don't have a scientific explanation precisely for why. But, you know, I think we need open spaces. We need to be outside. But I think for me personally, I think writing this book helps a lot because I don't know if you watch Harry Potter, that they have this device called a pensieve. So you use a magic wand, you basically take a thought out of your head, take a memory out of your head, and you dump it in the device. So it's a way to clear your head. You know, if your head is a laptop, and if you're writing, it's like offloading stuff to the cloud.
Right. The other thing that I was thinking about as reading the book, how interconnected we are, not just our economies, our governments, and the sort, how people are, thanks to technology. That's something that we've acutely been made aware of in these past few months. Work has changed for a lot of people. Family relations have obviously changed for a lot of people. Do you think these changes, how we interact with one another, do you think that's permanently changed? I mean, if we ever get back to normal, whatever that is, will how we interact with one another, will that be different, say?
Yeah, I think absolutely things will be permanently changed. And I think we will eventually find a normal. We will find an equilibrium, and we will find something that we can live with. But I don't think it will be back to as it were before. Just a couple of days ago, I tried to watch Tenet on the opening night. And mm-hmm. I think it used to be a time when you can just show up at a movie theater. But now I think everything, for many people, every interaction with the outside world, it has to be scheduled and planned.
Yeah. The other thing I enjoyed about your book, Ethan, are the sketches of the people that you give. I mean, I keep thinking of your uncle in China, and I'm wondering, I was actually kind of wondering if he'd review the book and how that would read in an email to his kids.
Yeah, that's a great thought. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, he might, you know, everyone in the book knows that I'm writing about them. Yeah. So there's no surprise to them. But yeah, he's definitely a character, a family eccentric, but in a good way.
Indeed. Do you keep in touch with Risako?
I want to say I do, but I don't think I've spoken to her for a month. Maybe the last time I spoke to her was a month ago. She is back in Japan, and she revealed to me she has three cats, and the black one is particularly cute.
I thought she's a particularly compelling character in the book. For people listening to us, you meet her in Germany. She's a student there, right?
Yes, she was on exchange, and
right.
she was studying Germanic literature. She reads a lot of books in German, and the German is much, much better than mine.
And I thought it was fascinating because here you were from two different countries, essentially, in a different country altogether, while the world is changing as it is, and to see your interactions as they were. I thought it was just fascinating, and it made me wonder how, you know, if you'd kept in touch, I guess.
Mm-hmm. We definitely kept in touch. I talked to him on WhatsApp from time to time.
Yeah. What, you talk about what it was like writing a book like this. Did you find that as you were writing, because there was stuff happening all the time, that you viewed yourself as sort of trying to record it, not only for yourself, but for posterity, say? I mean, I guess that's the work of a journalist, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking of a quote that there is, I think a journalist writes the history of today or something. I don't think I got that exactly correct. But yeah, I think things are definitely moving very quickly. And if you go back to the prologue when I wrote that, I think 9 months or 6 months after everything, there were nearly 9 million cases. And that figure, that is very much outdated by now.
Yeah, journalists write the first draft of history. I think that's how it goes.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Right. This brings up an interesting point in terms of because you write about this in the book, about disinformation online and elsewhere, promoted by conspiracy theorists or governments themselves. You give us a great sense of how China has handled informing its people and the wider world in the book. What can we do? I mean, they're all talking about a second wave and the sort. How do we gird ourselves against misinformation just as we do, say, a virus?
Uh-huh. I think that's a good question. I think the most appropriate answer will come from people smarter than me. I think one point I raised in the book is that most countries, they were not prepared for this, but there were some who dealt with it reasonably well. And they were able to do so because their people had, they trusted their government to do the right thing. And I think a lot of the reason, a great part of why misinformation or disinformation can thrive is when people don't trust their news sources, when they don't trust the establishment. And to be sure, the onus isn't on people to trust the government. The onus is on government to earn that trust. And I think... you know, how do we gird ourselves? I think public trust, that is the most important quality to cultivate.
It's a quality in leadership that I think we've been quite aware of in terms of which leaders have it and don't, right?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like you see what happened in New Zealand and you contrast that with what is happening in the U.S.
Yeah. Did you find over these last few months, the months to come, even that looking to history, looking, say, to other plagues, the plague, for example, even reading Camus for comparison, do you think that's useful at all as we think about what's to come?
I think that is definitely useful, and I think useful in two different ways. The nonfiction, what we learn from past pandemics, and I think it definitely helps us chart the way forward. And if we see how that has affected society, because there are people who say these things go in cycles, and I think looking at fiction, there was a great New Yorker piece about what our plague fiction is, why we have plague fiction, why we keep writing about this subject. And it's ultimately about what we feel we lose in such pandemics, and it's not so much the biological consequences. It robs us of what makes us humans and what makes us people, like all these social interactions.
The other thing that I was wondering about, because people listening to this might already gather, you take us through the last 9 months or so of what we've all gone through, and you've taken us to these places that we obviously can't have traveled to. There are a lot of places that you're obviously familiar with, having lived there for a certain amount of time. I'm talking about Singapore and Germany and Canada, of course. Is Canada home for you? I mean, I'm wondering where in the world you feel most at home.
Mm-hmm. Well, Canada is home, definitely. I live here.
I mean, you get to Germany, and it feels familiar, it feels comfortable even, the same in Singapore. China, even, because you have family there, seems, there's an ease that you seem to get around in with. I mean, that's going to definitely change, though, I mean, because we're not going to be able to travel for a while, right?
Oh yeah. That is a good point you raise. I'm definitely very sad about the decline of travel. And now, if I go to any of these places, it's a 14-day quarantine on both sides.
Yeah.
So it's essentially 28 days gone. So, I don't think I'll be traveling for a long time, and I might not see my parents for a while.
Yeah. You've written about it in this book, obviously. You're a journalist, and you follow this regularly. One would assume you're the right person to ask about how this story ends or where we're headed in the next few months. Have you got a sense, looking at how things have been handled the last nine, what's in store as we enter the second wave, if you will?
Mm-hmm. I'd hate to make precise predictions, but I think I can speak broadly, and I think I can give myself a pat on the back because I think I definitely called the throne speech that I think we are moving towards bigger government and amid crisis, that is what people want. And I think that is a trend that we will see across the world. And I think also eventually we will live in a larger, more walled up, more ethnically and nationally divided world. And I hope I'm wrong about that.
Yeah. As I was finishing the book, this doesn't happen very often, where I was wondering what's next. You know, I mean, I was looking forward to our chatting because then I would be able to ask you, you know, what's happened since to certain people and that you talk about in the book. Could there be, say, a year from now, a volume two of this?
Well, I never say never. That will depend on my publisher, and it will clearly depend on what the world will look like in a year or two. And I don't have a clue, with respect to the specifics. And I think I write in the book that a guy, when he a Chinese premier, when he was asked about the impact of the French Revolution, and he just said it is too early to tell.
What have you noticed in terms of yourself as a journalist, as a writer, as an observer, as an introvert, even? Have you noticed what's changed in you over the last 9 months?
That is definitely an interesting question. I don't think I can change that much by the pandemic specifically. I mean, but I definitely experienced many things for the first time, and it was definitely, I think, especially all these travel disruptions is something I wish I never had to go through. And writing this book in such a short period of time, I have learned to never commit myself to such a schedule ever again.
Yeah. Well, it's an enjoyable book as much as one can enjoy talking about a pandemic, or reading about one. Certainly, I enjoyed reading this book. It's because we've lived through it every day. We tend to forget things, and so it's the book's a marvelous way to go back and remember what we saw in the news that day or what was happening in the wider world. And so anyway, so congratulations on this book and good luck with it. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. It was an absolute pleasure.
The book is called Field Notes from a Pandemic, A Journey Through a World Suspended. It is published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland & Stewart. EthanLou.com is the website for more. Ethan Liu, join me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.